Marty before us. Welcome to the committee, Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This bill is simply to undo a floor amendment last year in the Senate on modification to the gift ban, and I think Senate Counsel actually has a one-word amendment that was not corrected in this version that would like to be taken up. But I'd like to go back to where the law was prior to last year. And again, my argument on this law has been around for about 20 years now, and people have blamed it for a lot of things or whatever. But the bottom line is, I think the point behind the law is still sound, and I think that when you see how people have pushed away at the limits of the law many times, and I think most people here even don't understand the law. I keep hearing people say that gifts under $5 in value are allowed, and as you can see, the law in front of you, plaques and trinkets, informational material, but it's not like, I mean, I've been to many events where, oh, it's under $5 worth of food or whatever. We've had a clean law that's been simple to understand, even if people don't, and I'm just concerned with this change. I don't think there was a big public outcry saying we have to weaken the law. I'd like to have the law restored the way it was. Be happy to take questions about it, but I wanted to have Mr. Schroeder from Common Cause to speak to the bill as well.
Before that, Senator Eakin moves the A1 amendment that would get the bill in the shape that Senator Marty would like. This is the first committee stop for this bill. Is there any discussion? All in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The A1 is amended or is adopted.
And with that, Madam Chair, I believe the bill now is restoring the law at exactly the same wording it was prior to last year.
Mr. Schroeder, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeremy Schroeder, and I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota, a nonpartisan good government watchdog group. I'm here supporting Senate File 1730 to reinstate the gift ban, and I ask for your affirmative vote. To you, I, or others that work closely at the Capitol, this may seem like a very small issue, but I cannot stress enough how important this bill is to retain Minnesotans' faith in their local elected officials. In government, appearing ethical is just as important as being ethical. Most people on either side or any of this or any other issue would agree that elected office is not and cannot appear to be the appropriate venue to resolve personal grievances or make personal gains. And while we have avoided the scandals that have plagued other states, the public is still losing faith in its government. Right now, Congress inspires the lowest level of confidence of any institution since Gallup began exploring the question in 1973. 60% of Americans say they're members of Congress are more likely to vote in a way that pleases their financial supporters, while only 20% think representatives would vote in the best interest of their constituents. 84% of members elected to the House of Representatives in 2012 and more than half of the members of the Senate received more money from the 1/10,000th percent of the population than from all of their small donors combined. In Minnesota and throughout the nation, limits and bans on contributions get pushed to their legal limit. And while this is completely legal and proper, we need to take care not to push these limits so far as to lose the trust of the public. This is a problem when people do not have faith in their democracy. The legitimacy of our democracy depends on the consent of the governed. And while we are not Congress, we cannot ignore the effects of Washington partisan gridlock here in Minnesota. The gift ban has been a proud Minnesota tradition, and it is time to reinstate all of it. Thank you very much, and I'll answer any of your questions.
Is there anybody in the audience who wishes to testify on Senate File 1730 as amended? Is there any more discussion before the committee? Seeing none, Senator Eakin moves that Senate File 1730 as amended be recommended to pass and move to the Committee on Rules and Administration. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Marty, next before the committee is Senate File 2443.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for that last bill. Senate File 2443 also is one that came about because of some of the changes in last year's bill. The bill title actually even as it passed into law, said bill for an act relating to increased disclosure, and actually the substance of the bill had some provisions that were moving the opposite direction. And at the time it happened, one of the questions I had, and I understand why it was with a motivation for changing it, but the amount of a contribution that must be reported in campaign finance reports has been, for a number of years, it's been $100 has been the breaking point. If you give $100 and one penny or more, you have to disclose. If you give $100 or less, you don't have to. And it was changed last year in that bill to be over $200 you'd have to report instead of over $100. So anything $200 or less does not have to be reported. And I actually offered successfully a floor amendment at the time saying, look, I understand people are concerned about the added burden for treasurers, many of whom are volunteers and so on. But I said, if we're going to be doing this, at the least, I'd make the argument that those whose job it is to influence our behavior here at the Capitol, we ought to recognize there's a difference there. There are about 1,500 registered lobbyists and principals that hire them, probably a similar number of principals and so on, and that those folks, we've already recognized that there's a difference. They're not allowed to contribute to us during a session. There are limits on the amount they can contribute in general. But my point would be that if I'm a registered lobbyist, I'm one of 1,500 people in the state whose job it is to influence the way you as a legislator vote on an issue, and if we are going to allow them to make contributions, it seems to me that whenever people say we shouldn't limit, we should just have full disclosure, well, this is saying, okay, well, if we're not going to limit that, let's have the full disclosure. And I think the standard contribution that a lot of us as members of the legislature would receive from these entities would be $100 in the past, and I think there's likely to be a lot more $200 ones. And my point is if I, as a registered lobbyist, am here to influence the legislature to do something, I could give, under the current law, $200 to every member of the legislature's campaign committee, and the public has no way of finding out about it because it's not reported. And so this bill, which is similar to a provision amendment I passed, it came out in conference committee on the floor last year, was one that said that a contribution from a registered lobbyist in this bill or a principal or a political committee or fund to campaign committees and caucuses would have to be reported even if it's less than $200. And it's a simple thing for those who say we shouldn't limit contributions, we should just have full disclosure. This is really full disclosure of those contributions. And I think this is a matter of openness in government that I think people expect. I think most people would be surprised to know that it is this way, where someone whose job it is to influence me could give me $200 and the public has no way of finding out about it. So with that, I've actually explained the bill. I wanted to ask for committee to consider the A2 amendment, which is to delete everything. And again, this is the first, I think that's in your packets, I think. No, it's not. I'm sorry about that. But the A2 amendment, it's to make it clear. I'm trying to get at, I'll wait till it's distributed, but maybe I can have Mr. Schrader speak to it before it's handed out, and then I'll go through the bill at that time.
Mr. Schrader or Senator Marty, if you could please explain, because we didn't have this ahead of time, if you could please explain the differences between
sure.
the bill as introduced and the A2 amendment.
Okay, and yes, and
we adopt it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there are a couple of things, one of which was the Mr. Goldsmith had suggested that on a number of the places where we said, like on page 1, line 27, you can see the report the date and amount of a contribution and the amount made. Right now, the bill, as it was introduced, skipped the date and he suggested, to be consistent with other statutes, we'd have date and amount. That was one of the changes, and that happened several times in the bill. And then the second one, because I'm mainly trying to get at the reporting of contributions from lobbyists and principals and political committees to those involved, the recipients of them, wanted to have those contributions disclosed. And in the old, the bill as introduced had a paragraph on page 4, a paragraph Q, similar to paragraph P, and saying that the report must include the amount of a contribution made. I mean, in other words, we wanted to have it, it's both ways here, except for if a political committee is giving to another political committee, rather than get into the hassle of whether political committees are reporting things they haven't received in the past. I wanted to make it just clear that the political committee or fund has to report contributions. You can see at the top of 4 on line 8. Instead of adding a new paragraph, we were simply saying they have to report contributions that are less than $200, as well as those in excess of $200, the current language of the law. So in other words, instead of, I'm sorry I didn't explain that very well, but basically what we're saying is that those political committees or funds must report the contributions they've made regardless of the amount, rather than saying they have to report the contributions they receive. In other words, everybody have to report the contributions received under $200, except a political committee that's getting one from the other. And maybe I was misunderstanding what the law was, but I think right now a political committee receiving a contribution from another political committee does not have to disclose it, and therefore saying we're trying to close the loopholes for those under 200. I'm just trying to tighten up the bill a little bit there.
Okay. Madam Chair, I'll move the A2 amendment.
Senator Eakin moves the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape that Senator Marty would like. Is there any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The A2 is adopted. So, Mr. Schrader, to the language that's before us.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is, again, Jeremy Schrader, and I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota, and I'm here supporting Senate File 2443. 2443 would allow Minnesotans to know who is trying to influence their democracy and is the first step toward curbing the large amounts of special interest money taking over our elections and government. I will be very brief. Much of my previous testimony still applies to this bill. One thing I will add is that Minnesota currently ranks an F when it comes to lobbyist disclosure laws. I was shocked to hear this, and many in the public were as well. As I stated earlier, it is not only important to avoid corruption, but the appearance of corruption to ensure the public's trust. We may have avoided the scandals, but without the limits and laws to prevent corruption, we are simply waiting for the scandal to happen. Thank you very much, and I hope for your affirmative vote.
Is there any discussion? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either in support or in opposition to Senate File 2565? Oh, I'm sorry, 2443. Senator Rest.
I have a question. Senator Marty, Madam Chair, you're not proposing that any other individual other than a lobbyist contribution to any of these entities be reported in amounts under $200. Is that correct?
That's Senator correct, Marty. Madam Chair.
And so,
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, so somebody gives me $500, but they're not a lobbyist. Isn't that trying to influence me? And so, what's the corrupting influence here?
Senator,
that of the money or of who's giving it?
Senator Rest, just to remind you now, if you're a donor over $200. A lobbyist or not, you do have to disclose that.
But he's getting rid of that for lobbyists only, correct?
That's correct. But
yes,
I think you said if an individual gives more than $500, would.
I understand that.
Have to disclose.
So just change the number to 200. Okay.
Senator Marty.
Yes. Madam Chair, Senator Rest, right now, if Mr. Schrader, you are a registered lobbyist? If he's a registered lobbyist, if he and I would both give $200 to you, you wouldn't have to report either one of them. Mm-hmm. Under this bill, you'd have to report his contribution. If it was a $200 contribution, you would have to report his but not mine. And the argument I would make for why that distinction, first of all, I will say we already recognize a difference there. He cannot contribute to you during the legislative session, whereas I could. We have a cap on how many, in aggregate, contributions from certain donors, which would include lobbyists, can give. We're already recognizing differences between them. And the difference I would make between that is it's his job and it's the professional, those who are paid to lobby us, it's their job to try and persuade us to do certain things. And my argument has been in the past, I've tried to argue that they should not be able to make those campaign contributions. The legislature has not agreed with that. But my argument is at least the public should have a right to know if somebody who's trying to influence us is making $200 contributions to us. And so when the decision was made last year to increase the amount that a donor can give that's not reported because of the burden on treasurers and everything else, my suggestion is that, therefore, at least let's recognize that these folks are different. And if you don't think we should limit the contributions, at a minimum, I hear people of both parties saying very strongly, but we should have full disclosure. And again, a registered lobbyist could, in theory, give $200 to every single legislative candidate in the state, and it wouldn't show up anywhere.
Senator Marty, I'd just point out, too, that because lobbyists need to register with the board, their information is already in the campaign finance data software, so it's not as much of a burden for treasurers of campaign committees to go out and obtain that all that information that's required because it's already in the software that we all have to use.
Exactly, Madam Chair. And also, any checks received from them has to have their registration number on, so we would know we're receiving that at the time. So it is, as you said, it's not a huge burden for the treasurer to report this.
Senator Marty, I don't think that the number has to be on their checks, just to clarify that. I don't remember seeing that because I know I've had to go up and look it up.
Madam Chair, I'm pretty sure. I think Mr. Goldsmith says.
Okay, great.
That was somebody, maybe you or somebody, I thought changed that a few years ago to require that.
Senator Rest, and then Senator Newman.
I'll come back to it. I lost my train of thought.
Senator
with your
Newman.
Intervening comment. Sorry.
I'll buy you some time, Senator Rest.
Thank you very much.
Senator Marty, I don't have a great deal of objection to your bill. I really don't. It seems to me like what you are trying to address is either the actual or perceived or possible corrupting influence that lobbyists who contribute to legislative campaigns may have on us. And I'd hazard a guess let me rephrase it this way. Other than an opinion or other than the fact that you are concerned about the corrupting influences of lobbyists on us, do you have any empirical data or studies or anything in the way of background foundation that would lend credence to your request to pass this bill and give us a reason, other than an opinion, to support your proposal?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, let me give you I hope not too much detail, but the whole issue here, first of all, is background. I'm not suggesting that people who donate money to us, registered lobbyists or others, are dishonorable people in any way, shape, or form. I think we all deal with lobbyists on a regular day. We get along with them well. They're very professional people. I would make the case that somebody who receives a campaign contribution and somebody who gives a campaign contribution may be both honorable people and not intend anything dishonorable about it. But I think the problem is that is a system that has a conflict of interest in it. even if you want to do well and I want to do right, we are still influenced as human beings. Psychology 101 courses can talk about reciprocity and the feeling somebody gives you something, even something you don't want, how you feel indebted to them, and subconsciously it changes your behavior. We're not talking about somebody saying, oh, I'll give you a contribution, you'll vote for my bill. We're not talking about a quid pro quo. We're talking about not corruption. I would make the premise that I don't know of any members of either party in this legislature that are corrupt. I don't know of people in the lobbying corps who are corrupt. I'm just saying that there is an inherent conflict of interest when we as human beings give each other gifts, when we give each other campaign contributions, and $200 may not be hugely significant in a lot of people in the political process, but to, I think, a lot of our constituents, very few of whom could afford to or give $200 or $100 contributions, it does influence us. And let me go back one example that I think you would remember, because I think our generation remembers back in the 60s or 70s when they had the Hare Krishna people at the airports. And at first they went around handing out religious tracts, which didn't do them a lot of good. And then they started handing out carnations. And they'd walk along in their robes and hand you a carnation when you're going off to your plane, and people would push them, no thanks, I don't want it. No, I insist, it's a gift. And it was amazing how many people would find, okay, I'll take the 25-cent carnation and, well, would you help us by supporting our ministry with $10 or whatever? Nobody'd do that. They'd only give a buck or two for a 25-cent carnation that they didn't want. And matter of fact, one psychologist studying the phenomenon noticed how many of the carnations were in a garbage can 200 yards away from where they were handed them. There were people who were bothered by this. They took the gift. They were forced to do that. Psychology 101 talks about reciprocity, and the point is not corrupt people. The point is a system that has an inherent conflict of interest. So what I'd like to make the case on is that even though people of goodwill are making campaign contributions, that it has an impact. And it has a psychological impact. And my point is you don't have to agree that there is one or not. It's just the fact is that a lot of psychologists will tell you the reality is even small gifts, even ones we don't want, change our behavior. And so I'm making the case that at least, even if you don't think we should limit the contributions, at least we should have full disclosure so the public can, so it's transparent.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Senator Marty, for that explanation, because that really does help. I mean, it isn't as though you are aware of any studies involving overt corruption. This is more of almost a subliminal idea that if we are given gifts of money or dinner or whatever the case might be, what you are arguing is that the psychological studies indicate that somehow subliminally that may influence the way we interact with lobbyists. Is that sort of on target of what you're talking about?
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, I think that's a fair characterization, but yes.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Ress and then Senator
Thank
Eden.
You. I just have two questions. I'm trying to find where the language would require a political action committee to make the same kind of reporting as a lobbyist. Where is that language?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I may turn to either Mr. Goldsmith or Senate Counsel, but I think in paragraph K on page 4, line 8, report must disclose the name and address of each political committee, political fund, principal campaign committee or party unit to which contributions have been made, regardless of the amount. In other words, if a political committee, they're among these reporters, if they make a contribution to a political principal campaign committee or party unit and so on, they have to report them. And then paragraph lines 4.23 and on, candidate, principal campaign committee, or party unit must report the date and amount of the contribution received from any of these entities. So it's dual reporting. In other words, they have to report what they are giving. We have to report what we are receiving.
But Senator,
Chair,
Senator Rest, I think a political committee is the same as a political action committee.
Yes, I understand that. But in K, it says that the report must disclose contributions. Of the committee to which a contribution has been made, not that they have made. Am I reading that wrong?
Madam Chair, you're reading it correct, except K applies to the political committees. So if a political committee makes a contribution to a principal campaign committee, party unit, or another political committee or political fund, they have to report it. So you're right about what it's saying there, but they are required. They're the reporters as well.
And then,
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, the Campaign Finance Board has not been able to update the changes that were made in the 2013 law, and I wonder what assurances we have that they'll be able to update changes that we make in 2014 in Campaign Finance Reporter, because otherwise it's going to be chaos.
Mr. Goldsmith, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Gary Goldsmith, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. To Senator Rest's question, which she raised last week as well, I met with staff on Thursday, and they informed me that day they were ready to release the new version of the software to accommodate all of the changes made last year on Friday, and I told them not to release it on Friday because there wouldn't be staff over the weekend to provide support should that be needed. So I haven't had a chance to talk to staff this morning to see if it was released, but it's my understanding and expectation that those are going to be released this week if they weren't already released today. Now, those changes were significant and required us to do some changes to the overall way that the software operates. For example, limits categories are now driven by a table that tells what the limit is for a particular office rather than by a fixed number that was the case before, because even now, for example, the itemization threshold for a ballot question committee is different than the itemization threshold for a candidate or political committee or fund. And, of course, donor limits are different based on the office that a person is running for, and expenditure limits are different. So we made a lot of changes. Those changes will help facilitate similar types of changes that the legislature should make, including changes that would require, for example, itemization at different thresholds than the two that are now in place. Now, certainly it will take some time, and I haven't had a chance to review this particular bill to ask staff to what extent our current structure will support that, but I will say that based on what I know from the process we've gone through, that it will be easier the next time than it was this last time.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. Senator Eakin, you had your hand up before, and then Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I actually, this goes back to a question that Senator Newman had asked earlier, and I just thought that in terms of the influence that this may have on elected officials or those that are running for office, and I think it goes beyond the influence, though. It's also just revealing where a candidate may be on particular issues, because those that are making the contributions aren't doing it necessarily to influence the candidate, but to help the candidate because they happen to have similar positions and think the same way. So, and the public is allowed to know where those funds are coming from and may get a better idea of where that candidate stands on particular issues as a result. So I think it goes beyond just the issue of influence. It's just a matter of revelation of where a candidate may be on particular issues.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, just a couple things. One is that the registration number doesn't have to be on the check, but it has to be included, not necessarily on the check. And then a dollar or $500 still needs to be entered. So the amount of labor or the effort is immaterial to actually the dollar amount. I think the criticalness, though, as Senator Rest made the point, is that the software be accurate, because that's so crucial as to compliance with these things, but that can be worked around to some degree. But I would also say, Senator Marty, I certainly do support transparency. I think that's really important to have a knowledge and a background of that. I think that's it's one thing. But I would concur with Senator Eakin in saying that generally dollars contributed are because you're going in the same direction, not necessarily to change direction. those dollar amounts are rarely going to have an influence there. But I do think it is important that when I take a look at some of the ballot issues or other things moving forward, that I understand where someone is coming from. That transparency and that knowledge and information is very important. And I think in many other areas of life, that kind of transparency is more important in informing things and others rather than that it's going to change necessarily. I doubt, Senator Marty, that most any of us on these situations would have a change. I would agree that psychologically, and sometimes we would say amongst ourselves that we could use a little more good feelings amongst each other. And I think that the original, one of the other bills that you had here was about us going to places together that reduced the cost of attending them, that might facilitate our having a more amicable relationships amongst each other. So sometimes these things are way more complex than just an absolute direct line connected between a contribution and a recipient, and also being able to attend functions where we can be amicable together and develop some of those relationships that I hear from a lot more people. We wish you could all get along better. And then sometimes we pass laws that make it harder to go places where we can actually have an opportunity to get along as well. So I'm introducing those comments, Senator Marty, not necessarily as a for or against, but just comments in regards to the subject. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, does a contribution, or let me back up, does a gift to a legislator, in your mind, equal part of the contribution that you have herein stated in your bill?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, this bill is strictly dealing with campaign funds, campaign contributions, and so on, whether from lobbyists or principals or political committees or political funds.
Okay, and Madam Chair, so if I happen to go out to, let's say, a warehouse business in my district like I did a couple months ago and was offered a cup of coffee as we talked over the certain tax issues in the legislature and what the effect was on 450 jobs in my district, that would not trigger a contribution report on my behalf to the campaign finance disclosure board. Is that correct?
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer, no. I do not believe that. I mean,
even
there's been no reporting under the other bill, under the gift ban law. There's been no reporting of such things, and a warehouse, unless it is a principal, most warehouses are probably in a warehouse association. So some of them are principals, but in this case, no. This bill is only dealing with campaign finance.
Is there anyone in the audience who cares to testify on Senate File 2443? Any other discussion? Seeing none, Senator Eakin moves that Senate File 2443 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Rules Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion passes. Thank you very much, Senator Marty.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much and happy St. Patrick's Day.
Thank you. Senator Tomasoni, welcome to the Subcommittee on Elections. Senate File 2565.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't think I've ever been before this committee before.
I don't think so.
So happy St. Patrick's Day to you also. And
I forgot to wear green.
This is the best I could do for green. I have an author's amendment, Madam Chair, that I need to put on. It's an A14 amendment. It's just a technical amendment.
Is it in our packet? It's in the packets.
Madam Chair, I'd move Senator Tomasoni's amendment for him.
Here, it's the 0885 amendment. Senator Newman moves the A14-0885 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion is adopted. Senator Tomasoni, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 2665 allows the St. Louis County Commissioner in District 7 to be elected in the 2014 election cycle for 2 years instead of a four-year term, and then returns to a four-year term in 2016. And the reason for it is because in state law it had been determined that these county commissioner elections should be in staggered terms, and currently there's three county commissioners all representing the Iron Range who are getting their re-elections all in the same year. And so this is just putting it back to where it was in the past and also complying with the state statute. So I don't think it's controversial at all, and I'd just turn this over to Mr. Ungaro from St. Louis County that he can add to anything I didn't tell you about here.
Mr. Ungaro, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, John Ungaro, Government Relations Director for St. Louis County. You have before you in your packets, hopefully, a copy of the St. Louis County Board resolution supporting this change in legislation. And specifically to the 7th Commissioner District, what occurred there is from statehood up until 2002, that specific commissioner's district had a staggered term from the other range commissioners, the other two range commissioner seats. Unfortunately, in 2002, the county board was sued over its redistricting plan. The judge ordered that specific seat had to be up for re-election at the same time as the other two commissioner seats, and so we lost our historic stagger for the three range commissioner seats. Obviously, the three commissioners in the city of Duluth all have staggered terms, and the county board would like to return to the staggered terms that historically have been in place for the Iron Range commissioners. Also, the judge's order expired in 2012, so we are free now to make that change, and so the St. Louis County Board is requesting that you assist us in making that change so we can get back to that historic staggered term for the 7th Commissioner District in northern St. Louis County.
And Mr. Ungaro, so that commissioner that's currently serving would complete a two-year term and then after that run for re-election for a four-year term, and that would be then it would be staggered from there on out.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Madam Chair, he's currently in a four-year term. He would run for a two-year term, and then after the two-year term, he would run for a four-year term.
Okay.
Okay.
Senator Rest?
At the appropriate time, I'd move the bill.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on 2565? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, I just have a quick question, Madam Chair. Noticing the resolution of the commissioners, and welcome, Senator Tomasoni. Good to see you
here.
Pleasure
to be here, Senator Kiffmeyer.
And
did you bring any donuts today?
I think it's up to you to bring
right.
the donuts
yeah.
when you.
Right, Senator Tomasoni.
I don't bake as well as you do.
That's the tradition of this committee, so please note that. We're starting it now, but please note that for the next time.
She bakes really well, though. I don't know if you've eaten anything that she's ever made. But.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. I noticed you did have. Were there any cons to this at all? Is there any opposition or any basis for opposition at all? Or could you just make any comments as to what that might be? It looks like pretty unanimous.
There was, Madam Chair, there was one no vote, but I wasn't at that board meeting, so I can let Mr. Ungaro comment. I think it's a lot like former Representative Krinke, where he used to vote no on everything. I think this guy votes no on everything, so I'm not sure, though. But
okay.
Mr. Ungaro.
Madam Chair and Senator Kiffmeyer, as that resolution shows, there were five in favor and one opposed, and there was one commissioner missing. He did email the county board members and said that if he was there, he would have supported this resolution. So, yes, there was just one no vote.
All right. Thank you.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify? Seeing none, Senator Eakin moves that.
Madam Chair, I move.
Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Rest moves that Senate File 2565 as amended be recommended, passed, and referred to the Committee on Rules and Administration.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Senator Tomasoni, would you consider a friendly amendment to create the same staggered term application to the Met Council?
I don't know. Maybe.
Well, we can talk about it.
I don't know what I'd have to do with it, but I was worried you were going to say State Senate.
We have enough problems.
On the rest motion, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is recommended
Thank
to pass.
Thank you very much,
Thank you.
Madam
Thank
Chair.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. Senate File 2099, Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, this is the Committee of First Jurisdiction, so I do have an author's amendment, an A1 author's amendment, that would ask that that be distributed. And this offers, Madam Chair, a couple of clarifications.
It's being distributed right now. Senator Cohen, if you could just give us a minute. Senator Cohen moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape he would like. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate File 2099 is a bill that former Senate President Davies and myself have worked on over the last year. It offers some clarification, a Minnesota clarification, as to what is permissible in terms of corporate contributions. If members will note, on lines 15 and 23, there's a reference to federal. That was a mistake in the drafting of the bill that I had made, and part of the author's amendment removed that word. So this only deals with races within our jurisdiction, state and local races. But it makes clear that if there are to be corporate funds utilized in campaigns, that it must be done through amounts that are reported as individual income tax amounts or returns, corporate dividends, salaries, wages, bonuses, anything that would be reported as an income tax to make sure that if we're going to have contributions being derived from corporations, that it be done so in a way that comports with what actually is the individual part of the corporation as opposed to the corporate entity. So it provides that Minnesota clarification, which I think makes sense in terms of what would be involved. Now, Mr. Davies has worked on this for a while with myself, and he can also offer some testimony as to what our intent is.
Senator Davies, welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Jack Davies. I think I'll say one sentence after the sentence I just said, or the two. The bill will restore equity into the campaign finance law by eliminating an inequity created by the Citizens United case, because Citizens United case permitted contributions directly from the state, from the corporate treasury, and a person who received dividends has to pay individual income tax, but those revenues that have been diverted from the corporation and from the shareholders are contributed to politics free of individual income tax. That's all the bill does.
So again, Madam Chair, it offers that clarification. And as Senator Davies has pointed out, former Senator Davies has pointed out, it offers that clarification to the Federal Citizens United case with what I believe to be an appropriate Minnesota take on that case. So a fairly simple bill. I would be happy to stand for any questions or debate.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Cohen, I'm going to support your bill, but I do have a problem with lines 1, 9, and 10, and 1, 16, and 17 with the use of purpose language. Seems to me the bill is strong enough without having to assert extraneous language, and so In that regard, Madam Chair, I would move to delete after the head note line 9 and line 10 to the period and capitalize the P in political, and the same thing in lines 117 and 118. It accomplishes it the same thing. You don't have to help it out with purpose, unnecessary purpose language.
And Senator Rest, to that motion, I think what you meant to say was that you would delete the language up until the comma.
Yes.
On lines 1.10 yes. and 1.18.
However it works, but to take out
that
in
first
both
clause.
Things, to ensure equal treatment under the law and equal explain opportunity for political participation, I think the bill does that, and you don't need to state it in the statute. And the same thing with lines 117 and 118.
And Madam Chair, as I looked over the I was going to make the same comment, Madam Chair, as you did, but as I looked over the language, I happen to agree with Senator Rest.
Right.
And,
so do I.
And would support that amendment.
So on Senator Rest's motion, does everybody understand it? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails.
So, Madam Chair, if there's no further discussion, I move that Senate File 2099 as amended be recommended to pass and we refer to the full Committee on Rules.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Cohen, as I've listened to the discussion, does this really mean that a corporation, if they were planning on getting themselves involved in a contribution for a political purpose, must file on their tax return the appropriate line where they are seeking the tax deduction?
Madam Chair, Senator, that'd be great. For state and local races, obviously not for federal races.
And
Senator
Cohen, thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Cohen, is there, I don't know of any other place in law where we force someone to file for a tax deduction. And I'm wondering if this is breaking new ground.
Sarah Cohen.
Madam Chair, I think what it means rather is that they would have to pay out the money as wages and have the recipient of those make the contribution.
Well, Madam Chair.
Mr. Chair, excuse me, Senator Limmer, I assume that if the Tax Committee has problems with this, they will request that they get this bill if it passes the Rules Committee?
Well, Madam Chair, maybe something to put into the record for future discussion, and that would be is what if the monies in a corporate account were excess corporate profit that they were holding or holding as a reserve fund or something? I could see where that money could be used for a campaign contribution. And not at the expense of any worker salary.
Senator
is
Cohen.
Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Mr. Limmer, I'm not sure that would be correct. I think the economy would be, I'm not a CFO of a corporation in town, but I don't think that would be necessary, as this is stated.
Senator Cohen, do you know if the Tax Committee has requested this bill?
I have they've not
have
notified me
that yet.
Madam Chair, I don't
Davies.
Think it has to go to the Tax Committee because it has no impact on state revenue, no impact on state on burdens. Its whole impact is an elections impact of restoring equity to the political system.
Madam Chair,
Senator Limmer.
If a gross dollar amount of a corporation is not used as a deduction, it most likely would affect the tax rate that corporation would have to pay. So I would contend that it would, in a small way, affect the revenue income expectations in the state.
Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, I've not heard from the chairman of the Tax Committee or staff of the Tax Committee that they're looking for the bill. Obviously, when the bill, to be honest, Senator Scoy serves on the Rules Committee. If he feels in hearing the bill in the Rules Committee that it should proceed to the Tax Committee, he'll let me know, maybe let the full Rules Committee know.
Is there anybody who wishes to testify on this bill? Mr. Schrader.
Mr. Schrader.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeremy Schrader. I'm the Executive Director of Common Cause Minnesota, and I'm here supporting 2099, an extremely common-sense bill to ensure corporations do not have special rights over citizens when it comes to campaign contributions. I don't have anything better to say other than Senator Davies, so I will just stand for any questions and ask for your affirmative vote.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Cohen, it's an area that I'm not very familiar with, but it seems as though this bill targets for-profit corporations. And I believe that there are any number of other legal entities that could conceivably contribute to political campaigns and political funds, et cetera. Business partnerships, limited liability partnerships, nonprofit corporations, labor unions. I mean, there's lots and lots of different legal entities. And apparently the premise here is, for bringing this bill forward, is that there is some perceived or perception that the playing field isn't level. And I'm just wondering, what is the inequity that is being perceived here, where we're simply targeting business corporations that operate for purposes of a profit, whereas there's any number of other legal entities that also try to influence the outcome of elections? And this seems to me to be a hurdle that is being placed in front of corporations. It's clever, but it isn't present for other legal entities.
Well,
Senator Cohen.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, a couple things. first of all, the language of the bill does deal with the limited liability companies if they're paying taxes. Second, Senator Davies made reference to the Citizens United case. You talk about labor unions. Labor unions don't make contributions. Now, it's possible that labor unions, through the dues mechanism, might collect money to distribute to candidates in the same way that there could be a corporate PAC. This doesn't deal with corporate PACs. If there's a collection of individuals working within the company combined to contribute to a PAC, doesn't deal with that. So this doesn't prohibit entities that pre-Citizens United would be allowed to put together a PAC or some type of PAC facsimile and make contributions to candidates. That's the uneven playing field. There's a world of difference between some type of corporate PAC, which will still be allowed to proceed, between what I'll call a labor union PAC, which will be allowed to proceed, as has been the case pre-Citizens United, and the distinction with Citizens United, which allows a corporation or the limited liability company to utilize monies from their corporate treasury, which are otherwise subject to income tax, to then send in some significant amount to that individual candidate. Now, obviously, as a state legislature, we can't deal with what happens on a federal level, and that's why I took out that federal language. But this deals with an absolute inequity that does exist, and that is to be distinguished from pre-Citizens United.
Madam Chair.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just an observation and then just a follow-up question, Senator Cohen. this bill does deal with corporations. It does deal with limited liability companies. I do not believe it deals with, at least specifically, with business partnerships. I don't think it deals with limited liability partnerships, which also are in the business of, you know, making money. As to the inequity, I do see an inequity, for instance, with nonprofit corporations and labor unions, to somehow claim that for instance, labor unions, might use their membership dues or a portion of their membership dues to influence the outcome in political matters is, I think, being a little disingenuous when, in point of fact, the dues are... The dues are deducted from paychecks and by the state and passed on. So I am not sold on the idea that there is somehow an unlevel playing field or an inequity that has been created by the Citizen United case. It seems to me that what the Citizens United case did was to, in effect, level the playing field. But that's just my observation, Senator Cohen. The other question I had for you is, what thought have you given towards whether or not this bill is constitutional? In other words, targeting a specific business entity and limiting their, by targeting them, limiting their ability to participate in the political process as outlined in Citizen United. Any thoughts that you have on the constitutionality of this bill?
Madam Chair, Cohen. Let me answer the second, then Mr. Davies wanted to answer the first. As to the second, Senator Newman, I can't speak to the constitutionality. I mean, obviously, you and I are both lawyers and know full well that unless something is brought in front of, the trial court and then subsequent appellate courts, it's constitutional until presumed otherwise. This language has been written in such a way that it one, deals with the state of Minnesota, second, draws the distinction relative to Citizens United, and I would hope on that basis would be determined to be constitutional. But we pass a lot of stuff around this place. In all honesty, that where we get into the realm of matters that have been dealt with by an appellate court, whether at a state or a federal level, that we might be uncertain. I just had a call on Thursday relative to a totally different subject, but some of the Indian Treaty litigation from X number of years ago. And I can tell you, as somebody who was a member of the legislature when the settlement between the Mille Lacs community and the Mille Lacs Band broke down, that we didn't know what would happen in terms of an ultimate court decision. We might have made some guesses, but we didn't know, and we proceeded accordingly. So this is the same. I mean, obviously, this is a subject matter, not just Citizens United, but all of campaign finance has been litigated in a significant way in the appellate courts, whether state or federal. I don't know if this might end up being the same. I would hope not, but can't speak to that. And Madam Chair, again, Mr. Davies wanted to answer Senator Newman's first question.
Senator Davies.
Well, on the constitutionality, I read the all of the opinions. After this idea occurred to me, I read all the opinions in Citizens United, the majority opinion, the concurring opinions, the dissenting opinions. It's a lot of pages. And the court never indicated any consciousness of the equal protection problem. And as far as partnerships, the gains of a partnership are taxed directly, are taxed to the individual partners. So it's quite a different animal than the corporate.
Senator Rest.
That was my point.
Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, Senator Cohen moves that Senate File 2099, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules and Administration. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Excuse me. The motion.
Madam Chair, would you give me that vote again?
I said that the motion prevails. Would you like
I think we have
raise of hands.
3-4 and 3 against. And
you neglected Senator Cohen.
I'm sorry, Senator Cohen. I would just look at
Would you like to see a raise
of? All right.
Yes.
I'm glad to hear that. Thank you.
So as I was saying, the motion prevails and the bill is recommended to pass.
I apologize to Senator Kiffmeyer for not stating that more loudly. Sorry.
Senator Sieben to Senate File 1915.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Members, this language that is before you, and there is a delete all amendment that's included in your packets that was also in the packets last week. This language reflects the board language, the language from the Campaign Finance Board that they recommended. The A2 delete all amendment also reflects the changes that were made through the committee process and that were passed off the floor of the Senate last year. So, and then these provisions that are before you are the ones that were later stripped out of in conference committee. The bill, if you recall, was first carried by Senator Rest, and then I ended up being the author of it at the end. So again, just to reiterate, this is the language that passed off the Senate floor last year and includes provisions that were recommended by the Campaign Finance Board. I'm wondering if Mr. Goldsmith would be willing to go through the actual substance of the amendment and the explanations of the proposed changes.
And, welcome, Mr. Goldsmith. And maybe before we do that, should we adopt the amendment first to get it in the shape and form that we'd like? So Senator Sieben moves the A2 delete all amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. And again, welcome, Mr. Goldsmith. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Gary Goldsmith. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board. I will go through the provisions of the bill, noting three changes that were made since the Senate last passed this bill last year, and then I also will have testimony on the bill itself. The bill contains three major provisions that improve disclosure in Minnesota, where we have fallen behind the federal law and some 20 other states in what we require of candidates and political committees, funds, and party units, and so on. The first area is in the definition of express advocacy, which is the term that we use to determine whether something is an independent expenditure or not. It's been clear for many years that publications that use words like vote for and vote against are certainly express advocacy, and in fact, that particular part of the definition was codified into statute last year. What was left out last year is the second part of the definition of express advocacy, and that's what is referred to as the functional equivalent of express advocacy. At the federal level, it was recognized that as soon as people believed that you had to say vote for or vote against a candidate before you would be required to register or disclose your activities, communications started coming out that avoided those words. And so Chief Justice Roberts in the Wisconsin Right to Life case recognized that there were other publications or other communications that could be subject to reporting besides those that specifically use the words vote for, vote against, et cetera. The language on page 1, lines 8 through 11, is the language that would make the functional equivalent component of the express advocacy definition part of our system of regulation and part of the way we define independent expenditures. This is just very slightly different from the language of the bill last year, because we've modified the language just slightly to even more closely track the language Justice Roberts used in the Wisconsin Right to Life case. So that would expand our independent expenditure law to require registration and disclosure if thresholds are met of communications that are subject to no other reasonable interpretation but that they are for the purpose of influencing elections. And I'll have more to say about that when I actually testify on the bill. Section 2 is a conforming change, as is Section 3. This is to add the new electioneering communications provision that I'm getting to next to the reporting statutes. And Section 4 is actually the electioneering communications part of the bill. Once the court recognized that express advocacy included the functional equivalent, so that if you could look at a communication and say, this can't be anything other than something to influence an election, communicators looked for the next way to avoid registration and disclosure, and they found it in the form of advertisements that typically say, call Senator Doe and thank her for her work to keep Minnesota taxes low, yeah, or call Representative Smith and tell him to stop raising taxes. Those types of communications can certainly have a purpose other than to influence an election, namely to influence how the candidate is going to vote. And so those communications are not express advocacy and are not independent expenditures, even when they're made without the involvement of the candidate. The federal government took steps to address this situation by enacting electioneering communications laws, as did some 20 other states. Electioneering communications laws typically take the form that the proposal in Section 4 does, which is to identify types of communications, put restrictions on the distribution that must be met before disclosure will be required, and establish a time frame. The Section 4 of this bill is modeled after the federal law, which has been upheld by various courts. In short, an electioneering communication is a communication that's broadcast or distributed in a certain time period. And section or subdivision 1 actually defines electioneering communication, and this is another place where there's a very slight change from the language from the bill last year. Last year, the bill did not include electronic mail or electronic text messaging, and it didn't include websites. It still doesn't include websites. And the approach to determining what can be and what will never be an electioneering communication is based on the types of communication that can be pushed out to a listener or to an observer without that person's consent. In other words, the recipient doesn't have to do anything to get the communication. So a billboard or something mailed to the recipient's home or dropped at the doorstep, an electronic mail or text message, is something that the recipient gets whether they want to or not. And those are included potentially as electioneering communications. On the other hand, tweets or websites are something that the visitor has to actually do something affirmative before they'll receive them. You have to go to a website, sign up to follow somebody on Twitter, or sign up to follow somebody on Facebook. And so because those things are voluntary with the recipient rather than with the sender, those are excluded as potential electioneering communications. Secondly, the communication has to refer to a clearly identified candidate, as all of these call senator and thank them always did. And then they must be made within a particular time period, and in the federal law, those of most of the states that I'm aware of, and in this proposal, that time period would be 30 days before a primary election and 60 days before a general election. And I won't touch every single piece of the bill, but in the exceptions, there's an exception that says that a communication made during a legislative session and for 10 days after a legislative session, and that's regular or special, is never going to be an electioneering communication. So that guarantees people that they will have the ability during any session and for 10 days after the session to get their messages out in any means to thank or urge legislators or officials to take or refrain from some sort of action. Now, the communication also has to be targeted to the relevant electorate, and there are thresholds, both with respect to the amount of money that must be spent and the number of impressions that must be made before it will be considered targeted to the relevant electorate. More importantly, there are specific exceptions, and again, there is a new exception. And I will see if I can turn to that. Okay. First of all, with regard to targeted to the relevant electorate, the concern came up last year that there are many organizations that do county fairs, state fairs, civic meetings, town festivals, church meetings, all sorts of things where they distribute literature and talk to people. And so there is a specific requirement that before a piece of literature is considered distributed to the relevant electorate, it must be either mailed directly to the voter's home or delivered directly to the voter's home. So only two pieces of communication or two types of communication are included, that is, direct mail and lit drops would be included. Also, in the previous bill, there was an exception for newsletters mailed to an organization's members, no matter where they lived or how many there were or when they were mailed. It did have some limitations. The current bill has removed the limitations, and so there's an exception for any communication that's just mailed to an organization's members, as long as they don't mail the same communication or substantially the same communication to people who are not members. So there's a broad membership, a member communication exception that wasn't in the previous bill. Also, there's a broad exception for nonpartisan voter guides. This was something that was brought to us by the nonprofit 501c3 charitable corporation community, and that was added. So the bill, as I say, mimics federal law. It has a lot more protection in it than federal law. The disclosure, if required, is triggered only by the event that triggers the disclosure. There are two approaches to disclosure in campaign finance board. Minnesota statutes up to now has had really only one approach, and that is a scheduled disclosure system. You all know that you have reports due on specific days. It's the same for lobbyists, economic interest. Everything has a date certain. We were actually sued a few years ago on this very subject, and in fact, one of the organizations that will appear, I think, today was the plaintiff in that lawsuit, and the claim was that Minnesota's structured, scheduled reporting requirements were too burdensome, that you had to report periodically, no matter whether you had any activity or not. And the argument in that case is the same argument that's been made in cases across the country challenging campaign finance disclosure laws, and the argument is that what is called event-based or event-triggered disclosure is a better solution. And so the electioneering communications provision has, in fact, this event-based or event-triggered disclosure. And so if an organization doesn't do anything that constitutes electioneering communications, they will never register with a report to the board. However, if they meet the threshold, the triggers, for event-based reporting, they will file a report once the trigger is met. Now, if they never meet the trigger again, they'll never file another report. On the other hand, the bill gives them the option, if they want to, of creating a political committee or fund, and then they can have scheduled reporting, which means they wouldn't have to monitor event-based triggers. So they can do either way. It's up to them to determine which is the least burdensome reporting that they might have. The final change is a change to existing law regarding what's called underlying source disclosure in the independent expenditure context, and the sections I've skipped over are conforming. I'm now on section 6 of the bill, which the substantive part is on page 11. Under our independent expenditure reporting system, the direct source of money used for independent expenditures, if it's money paid to a political committee or fund, is always identified. So if a nonprofit corporation gives a political committee some money, we're going to see the nonprofit corporation listed as the donor of that money. However, we don't see any information about where the nonprofit corporation got that money. Now, under existing law, there is an option where the committee could provide that information by prorating, where the nonprofit could provide that information by prorating its donation over its various donors. But there's another option, which we refer to as the pick-and-choose option, which allows the nonprofit to allocate its contribution to its donors on any basis they pick. And if they can allocate their contribution in a way that no donor is allocated more than $5,000, no donors are disclosed. And our experience with this particular provision has been that, with the exception of one or two cases, no donors are ever disclosed to help us know where a nonprofit corporation receives the money it uses to either make or donate to independent expenditure committees or funds. So what this bill would do would be remove the pick-and-choose method of disclosure in favor of requiring the pro rata method of disclosure. What this means in a nutshell is that if a nonprofit or other association, it's not limited to corporations, if an association uses half of its money for independent expenditures, then it would attribute half of each donor's donation to that purpose. And after doing that multiplication, any donor whose attribution amount was more than $5,000 would be disclosed. What this means as a practical matter is that because these organizations typically don't spend more than half of their money on independent expenditures because of corporate tax status concerns, the practical effect is that only donors of more than $10,000 would ever be disclosed. That's the substance of the bill. I would stand for questions on that. Otherwise, I do have some additional testimony about the purpose and intent of the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Sieben.
First, I just want to apologize to the committee that I was under the misunderstanding that the language was exactly the same as that we passed off the floor. But as Mr. Goldsmith indicated, there were some slight tweaks to it.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Sieben. And are there any questions for Mr. Goldsmith or Senator Sieben at this point? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of this is a lot of new language, and one of my overarching concerns is interpretation. And I look at this, and I can see a lot of lawsuits coming forward on this because there's a lot of words here that are subject to interpretation. And so one of the things is on page 5, line 16, called reliable media reports. Could you please give me a definition of a reliable media report?
Senator
Kiffmeyer, could you say the line number again?
Page 5, line 16, the first three words.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, first of all, this language is in the section that provides an exemption for nonpartisan voter guides. So it's language that would define what is not going to be an electioneering communication. And the concept is that the guide is to be, in fact, nonpartisan and not to inform the voter of how the proponent of the guide thinks the voter should vote. In other words, it shouldn't have a lot of narrative, opinion, editorial type content. And so the reason for the restriction that says if it includes other than the candidates' positions that come from the candidates, it should be recorded votes or reliable media reports, which you're correct, Senator Kiffmeyer, is undefined. But the purpose of that is to preclude these voter guides from including what one might call fringe media reports in a voter guide, which might be something that would in fact be to influence how the voter votes rather than simply defining the two candidates' positions.
Yeah, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the motive and the intentions. I don't question that whatsoever. I'm just looking at the subject to interpretation, and whether it's to be included in or excluded in is still a matter of definition, because I'm going to take a look at this and say, well, what's in and what's out, and so will anybody else, and they're going to say, well, what does this all mean? And I think especially in media reports, I've seen quite a few examples of incorrect media reports that we might have thought they were reliable, but not necessarily the case. So I think I just have questions like that. I think the other one is, Mr. Goldsmith, on line 519, just below that, where it says, any other communication specified in board rules or advisory opinions. And so it seems as though if we read the law, we couldn't just depend upon the law. Now we have to figure out what are the board rules and any advisory opinions as well. most people read the law, this is long enough as it is. And so is it the board's intention to add to all of this rules?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kiffmeyer, again, you're in the section that regards the exclusions from electioneering communications. So if you read the law, you will know what the statute says are excluded and what you don't have to worry about, therefore, and can promulgate without limit or registration. If you want to do something that isn't in the law as you read it, you either can look at advisory opinions or board rules or ask for an advisory opinion. This gives the board the opportunity or authority to establish things that you can do that would not be covered by electioneering communication law. It doesn't give the board the authority to expand or add to the things that are covered. So the law would be clear with what's excluded, but additional things might also be excluded, and if you were going to engage in something that wasn't covered in the statute itself, you might go to those secondary sources.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. I don't think that clears it up whatsoever, and I'll contend again that whether it's in the section of in or out, it doesn't matter, because either way, you must know. And if everything was so clear, why would you need additional rules or additional opinions if it was so clear? Obviously, the fact that this language is giving the board some room in rules or advisory opinions, it means it won't be that clear, and that there will be issues, and there will be questions, and there will be opinions or other additional things. So I don't think it's as clear as might be construed here. The other question I have is on page 4, line 30. And this one is about, again, whatever section it's in, whether it's in or out, my point is the same, because sometimes I read it in the first and then in the second. But at any rate, it says single issue or a narrow range of issues. Could you explain or give an example of what a single issue or narrow range might be?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, yes. Again, this is one of the characteristics of a nonpartisan voter guide. And this whole section about nonpartisan voter guide, by the way, was derived from IRS rules and opinions that have been established to allow these 501c3 corporations to engage in these kinds of guides without losing their IRS tax-exempt status, because 501c3 corporations are not allowed to influence elections. So these types of voter guides are designed in a way that they are not supposed to be influencing elections. And it's the IRS's position that a voter guide that focuses on a single issue is typically going to be to influence the election with regard to that issue. So that issue might be a liquor law issue or a daycare unionization issue or some single issue. If a voter guide is really intended to inform the electorate about candidates over a spectrum, they will include a broad range of issues.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't know that the definition of a voter guide, other than what I see in here, is restricting it. But in general, most 501c3s and others such as that do have an organizational purpose in keeping with that. And so I don't know that this restrictiveness here serves the general public any better at all. And I think the... I think on line 433, it goes on to say the questions and any other description of the issues are clear and unbiased in their structure and content. I have always found that clear you can probably manage in communication, but unbiased is generally what would you call it? Beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And so bias is very much one of those that I find that if you like it, it's not biased. If you don't like it, it is. And so I find this, again, to be a nebulous kind of a definition that is subject to a great deal of interpretation. One of the other final questions that I have, I can't really tell for sure right now, but does this apply to when we're talking about some of these disbursements that paid out of a segregated bank account, donated specifically and so on, and that it's in aggregate? One of the questions I have here is it's supposed to be attributed to an individual, but we have individual contribution limits. Does this affect those individual contribution limits, or is this above and beyond?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, with respect to electioneering communications and independent expenditures, there are no individual contribution limits. So these would be donations that are either made to 501c4s where there are no limits or made to committees or funds making electioneering communications or independent expenditures where there are no limits.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's it for right now. Thank you.
Oh, and Senator Rest, to this point, Senator Newman has had a question as well.
I have. I'm going to one of Senator Kiffmeyer's points, if that's okay. And that is the phrase on 516, reliable media reports. I guess I would be more comfortable with it being public statements and recorded votes because those are truly objective. And, you know, a newspaper, for example, may be reliable one day and not reliable another day in that that's why they have corrections. And so they may report something on a candidate's position that actually is not the case. And they just made a mistake. And yet, generally, they are a reliable source of information. So I, and even they've been known to report people's party affiliation incorrectly, or, and so it would be, you know, well, somebody says they're a Democrat, but the Star Tribune said they're a Republican. So which is it, Senator Rust? I mean, somehow that needs more specificity as a, so I probably wouldn't have zeroed in on that if Senator Kiffmeyer hadn't brought it up, but it does seem to me that needs a bit more scrutiny. I don't have any suggestion for changing it at this point, but I would just offer that as a suggestion to Senator Sieben to maybe get some different language that gets at the same idea of major news outlets. And the same thing is true for TV and stuff like that, too.
Okay. So, any comments? And Senator Newman, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Goldsmith, to the issue of express advocacy, what is being defined here as to what express advocacy is involves what I call a reasonable person standard. So my question to you is who or what entity would be in the position to make the determination of whether or not a reasonable person could come to no other conclusion?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, thank you for the question. That's a standard that's, as you know, widely used in the law. It's used in negligence law and all sorts of other areas of the law. I do want to point out to members that this particular use of the reasonable person standard is sort of actually the negative of the use of where it's commonly negative of the way it's more commonly used. So this doesn't say it's an electioneering or doesn't say that it's express advocacy if any reasonable person could conclude that it is. That would be far too vague and far too broad. It says it's express advocacy if no reasonable purpose can conclude otherwise. Now, first of all, this would come to the board in form of some kind of complaint if the board were required to rule on it, and the communicator would be asked what the explanation of the purpose is if the purpose is claimed to not be advocacy for the election or defeat of a candidate. And it would seem to me that because we have the requirement that no reasonable person could conclude that it's something else, that essentially every member of the six-member board that votes on this would have to conclude that there's no other logical, reasonable explanation but that this is advocacy for an election. because if any reasonable person, and I think the board members are all reasonable people, if any reasonable person can conclude otherwise, then it's not express advocacy. And ultimately, of course, under Chapter 10A, if a decision has to be made, it's the board that has to make that decision.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Goldsmith, I apologize for not phrasing my question accurately. I wasn't looking for an explanation as to why the board wants to use the reasonable person standard. I do understand what that standard is. My question was, and I'll rephrase it now so that there's no mistake, would it be correct that it would be the Campaign Finance Disclosure Board that's going to make the determination as to whether or not the reasonable standard has been violated?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair and Senator Newman, ultimately, yes, the legislature has placed Chapter 10A under the board's jurisdiction.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Newman.
If we go to electioneering communications, Mr. Goldsmith, just to sort of follow up on what Senator Kiffmeyer was talking about, if we look at election communications that do not include a single issue or narrow range of issues, would I be correct that it would be the board that would be making that determination as to whether or not the electioneering communication falls into that category of single issue or narrow range of issues? That's a board determination, correct?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, that is one of the criteria that would be examined in determining if a piece of communication is a nonpartisan voter guide. It's not the only criteria, but yes, the board has been vested with jurisdiction over Chapter 10A.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Newman.
Mr. Goldsmith, if we go on to page 5, Senator Kiffmeyer had raised an issue on line 16 about reliable media reports. You had used, I believe, the language of, well, that wouldn't include fringe reports or fringe voter guides. Would I be correct, Mr. Goldsmith, that ultimately it would be the board that would make the determination as to whether we are using or looking at reliable media reports or fringe media reports?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, yes.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Newman.
And Mr. Goldsmith, if we go then on to the other area that Senator Kiffmeyer was talking about on line 19, 5.19, any other communications specified by the board, rules or advisory opinions, it would then be the board that would make the determination as to what these all other communications are going to be. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, that's correct. It would be the board that would be providing additional exclusions from electioneering communications.
And the Mr. Chairman, I apologize. And the advisory opinions, Mr. Goldsmith, while I recognize the board has the statutory authority to issue advisory opinions, which is, frankly, somewhat unusual, would you agree with me that advisory opinions issued by the board do carry a good deal of weight and yet do not go through the formal rules process and could be considered, in effect, unadopted rules?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, respectfully, I would not agree with that categorization of advisory opinions. By statute, advisory opinions are binding only on the board, so they can be enforced against the board. And if a person acts according to what the board advised, the board cannot take action. However, the person is permitted to ignore the advisory opinion, and others do not have to follow it. So while there are statements of the sense of the board, they do not have the effect of rules.
One final question, Senator Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your indulgence. Mr. Goldsmith, can you give me a sense of how many times a candidate for office has ignored an advisory opinion and taken the board on?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Newman, I think that's probably zero or close to zero.
Thank you, Mr. Goldsmith. I appreciate your candid answers. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions before we continue? Okay, seeing none. Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, I believe there are people who want to speak still in favor and in opposition to it.
Sure. And I have on the list here Sherry Knuth from the League of Women Voters.
Right.
Is she here?
Yes, she is.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Knuth, and if you could state your name and position for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Sherry Knuth, and I am Policy and Outreach Manager for League of Women Voters, Minnesota. Despite Minnesota's strong culture of civic engagement, the systems that fuel Minnesota's democratic processes are in need of attention. The influence of money in politics represents a threat to the health of Minnesota and our national democratic system. LWV's position on campaign finance was researched through a two-year study and consensus process at the national level of our organization. Our position is that methods of financing political campaigns should ensure the public's right to know, combat corruption and undue influence, enable candidates to compete more equitably for public office, and allow maximum citizen participation in the political process. By limiting disclosure of independent expenditures to communications using only the magic words of advocacy, Minnesota law does not ensure the public's right to know or allow candidates to compete equitably. As many of you know, advertisers can easily communicate their messages without using the magic words. In fact, the Brennan Center for Justice has said, in layman's terms, an electioneering communication is typically an ad that trashes the candidate on election eve. Evaluating disclosure laws for independent spending in the 50 states, the National Institute on Money and State Politics gave Minnesota an F because our state does not require disclosure of electioneering communications. Determining how much money is spent for elections to state office remains elusive, the Institute states, when a state does not require full disclosure of both forms of independent spending, express advocacy, and electioneering communications. These failures in Minnesota's system have been exacerbated by the Citizens United decision in 2010, triggering an influx of millions of dollars into Minnesota elections by independent spenders. Data from the Campaign Finance Board indicates that in 2012, express advocacy by independent spenders exceeded spending by the candidates themselves by more than $4 million in Minnesota legislative races, period, sorry. This figure does not even account for the additional money spent on electioneering communications because Minnesota does not regulate that spending. Sometimes I have heard organizations claim that it will be a burden for them to provide disclosure because of their organization's small size or budget. The League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization that normally does not engage in any reportable activities and campaigns. However, in the 2012 campaign to defeat what was known as the Photo ID Amendment, we were required to disclose contributors and expenditures. We have a staff of 3 1/3 people and a budget of less than $400,000. Whatever burden we experienced in complying with the disclosure law was minimal when compared to ensuring the public's right to know who is attempting to influence their vote. The Federal Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act and 25 states require disclosure of electioneering communications. League of Women Voters urges you to join those states by adopting this bill. By requiring disclosure of electioneering communications, Minnesota would keep pace with the manner that elections are conducted in the 21st century and give voters the information that they need to cast an informed vote. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Knuth. And are there any questions? Okay, seeing none, thanks again for your testimony. And next we have Ms. Andrea Rao. Welcome, Ms. Rao. You can state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Andrea Rao, and I am here representing MCCL, Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. MCCL is a grassroots organization with a long history in Minnesota. As we did last session, MCCL opposes the proposed regulations on so-called electioneering communications in this bill because of the chilling effect that they would have on our ability and others' ability to engage in grassroots efforts, issue advocacy across the state. Issue advocacy groups are private organizations that provide a vehicle for average citizens to effectively participate in the political process by pooling their limited resources to enhance their individual voices. Additionally, issue advocacy groups exist to inform their membership on current events and legislative happenings related to the issues that they represent. Now, it seems to me that the legislation before you today and the electioneering communications provisions specifically are targeted to specific types of communications, as we just heard mentioned by a few different people. These are typically very negative kinds of communications that happen right before an election, and it's clear that they're meant to influence the election. Now, while that may be what's targeted with this legislation or what the advocates of the legislation are trying to get at, this bill actually goes very much beyond that and targets a lot of communications that organizations like MCCL and others do that are beyond that. Examples would be if there were a law going into effect on August 1st, which is well within the 30-day margin before a primary election. If an organization wanted to describe that law and happened to mention the elected official that helped to make that law a reality, which I think would be appropriate, that would be considered an electioneering communication. If there were a court ruling or a challenge to an issue, an existing law, that happened within 30 days before a primary or 60 days before a general election, and an issue advocacy organization which was impacted by that court challenge wanted to comment on it, asked for an elected official to comment on it, anything like that, or asked them to share their experience or expertise on the issue. That would be another example of a communication that I think is clearly not intended to affect an election, but which would be encompassed by these broad, overbroad, I would suggest, regulations. Also, it was discussed earlier that any communications related to a special session, including 10 days after that, would be excluded. Actually, the way that the legislation is written, it only includes conversations that happen specifically during a special session. But clearly, most folks would want to talk about and describe what happened in the special session the day after or several days after. Those would not be permitted under the way that this legislation is currently drafted. Also, if there were some kind of emerging issue, if there was some kind of national emergency or a major event that happened that folks then wanted to highlight, I think we saw this most recently. Most people saw reporting on the school lunches and, you know, kids getting their lunches taken away and being given a cold sandwich or no lunch at all, and that, you know, created a public outcry and got people talking about that issue almost immediately. If that report were to have come out 30 days before a primary, 60 days before a general election, and an organization with an interest in that kind of issue went to a legislator or quoted somebody, then that would be suddenly an electioneering communication. So clearly there are lots of different kinds of communications that can happen within that time frame. And remember, 30 days before a primary or 60 days before a general election, when you add that together, that is a quarter of the year. That's a significant period of time. That's not a very limited period of time. And so the disclosure requirements that would then be prompted by doing such communications, we feel, may not be burdensome to wealthy individuals or associations that are easily able to hire an attorney and an accountant to help them navigate the waters there and file their reports. But for a small organization that doesn't have a large staff and has a number of small donations, the burden can become immense very, very quickly. And though MCCL disagrees with this legislation in concept, for those that do advocate for full disclosure, this legislation is lacking as well. There are many loopholes that do exist in the legislation, allowing many different communications and organizations in Minnesota to continue acting as they currently do and avoid much of the meaningful disclosure that's claimed in this bill. In the end, we believe that this legislation will provide little meaningful disclosure of the largest voices, while the voices of smaller organizations and interests will be chilled. Regardless of the intent, it seems that the real effect of these burdensome reporting requirements is less to inform the public and more to deter citizens from publicly engaging in the issues of the day. Therefore, MCCL urges the subcommittee to reject this legislation. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Okay, seeing none, thank you again, Ms. Rao. And next we have Mr. John Knapp. Welcome, Mr. Knapp.
Thank you.
If you could state your name for the record,
yeah, please. Yeah, I do have a written statement as well.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, and members of the committee, my name is John Knapp. I'm with the Minneapolis law firm of Winthrop & Weinstein, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Business Partnership. The Minnesota Business Partnership has some concerns about this bill as they did last year. The first concern relates to the express advocacy provisions. The existing law that's applied in Minnesota is to use what's termed the magic words, which is a term of art that came from a 1976 United States Supreme Court decision in Buckley versus Valeo. And in that decision, what the court said is that magic words such as elect, defeat, vote for are words that they would consider to be political advocacy words. What this bill would do would be to substitute a reasonable person test, which is a broader, subjective, and context-based test, which will cause, we fear, some organizations to not exercise their free speech rights versus because of concerns about breaking this now ambiguous law. We're also concerned about the electioneering communications provision, which you've already discussed. We are concerned that creating this new category of regulated speech will discourage participation in the political process and unfairly burden organizations who would otherwise choose to communicate their views. And finally, we're concerned about the underlying source disclosure provision related to independent expenditures. As you may recall, the language that's in the law right now was adopted in 2010 in the months following the issuance of the Citizens United decision. And the business partnership at that time worked with Senator Rest, Representative Winkler, Governor Plenty's office to pass what was one of the first in the country laws requiring disclosure of independent expenditure contributions by businesses. We're concerned that this new standard would essentially require public disclosure of the membership of organizations such as the Business Partnership, the Chambers of Commerce, or many others. And there is ample Supreme Court precedent going back to a decision called NAACP versus Alabama, which recognizes that there can be a very chilling effect from disclosure of memberships in different associations. That is why, for example, the Internal Revenue Service does not require disclosure of memberships of associations when a nonprofit files its tax return. And I'd just like to mention, too, that there are two things that we wish that were in this bill that are not in this bill. The first is a repeal of the criminal penalties, which are in Minnesota law, section 211B.15 for corporations. What we're doing is we're adding two additional new categories of political speech, the express advocacy speech and the electioneering communication speech. For electioneering communications, there's a simple administrative penalty in the statute for everyone except for business corporations, because now business corporations are going to be subject by virtue of 211B.15 to criminal penalties if they engage in this type of speech. So we talked with Senator Cohen's bill a little bit earlier about creating a level playing field. Well, in our opinion, this creates about as unlevel a playing field as you could possibly have, because it provides criminal penalties of up to 5 years in jail for an individual or for a corporation, the loss of the corporation's right to do business for engaging in this kind of speech in violation of this new law. On the other hand, for individuals, for labor unions, for partnerships, for sole proprietorships, there are only simple administrative penalties. So that's one concern that we have that heightens our interest in the expansion of political speech that's reflected in this bill. The other thing that we think is missing is a theme of this bill and a theme of the legislation that you passed last year is to find ways to get money directly to candidates rather than through the independent expenditure channel. And right now, after Citizens United in Minnesota, that's really the only avenue that businesses have to influence the political discussion is through independent expenditures. There are no, for the most part, corporate political action committees in Minnesota because corporations cannot spend money in Minnesota to support political action committees. On the contrary, what you have at the federal level is what we think is a more balanced and fair approach. It was passed in the aftermath of World War II in 1948. Federal election campaign law allows labor unions to create pools of money to give to candidates, and it allows business corporations to create pools of money that are funded by their employees or, in the case of labor unions, funded by their members, which can then be given as contributions directly to candidates. So in the theme of trying to get money to candidates rather than to independent expenditure groups, we think it makes sense at this time to amend Minnesota law to allow corporations to support separate segregated funds whereby employees can contribute to funds and have those funds given to candidates directly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Okay. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Knapp. And anyone else? Yes. Welcome to the committee, and if you could please state your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members, good afternoon. My name is John Helmberger. I'm CEO of Minnesota Family Council, and as such, CEO of a nonpartisan 501c4 issue advocacy organization. I share the concerns that others have raised here about the severely chilling effect of this bill, as amended, on free speech, and also the onerous burden of the labyrinth of regulation that it would impose on one of the most important functions of nonprofits in elections, which is nonpartisan, issue-oriented voter education. Also, the overly broad latitude given to the Campaign Finance Board to exercise discretion in determining what constitutes express advocacy or electioneering communication. However, I'm here primarily today to address a serious concern about this bill as amended, and to amplify on what the gentleman who previously testified shared, the fact that Section 7 would attribute political speech to people who have done nothing of the kind, merely for making undesignated contributions to the general fund of such a nonprofit organization as the one that I lead. It would force speech on people who haven't chosen to engage in electioneering communications. It would require the false reporting of an undesignated contribution or portion thereof as having been given for express advocacy or for electioneering communications when, in fact, it was not. This potentially exposes the undesignated donor to threats, intimidation, harassment, and actual harm to themselves, their families, businesses, or employees, all for something they haven't done. This is unfair, it's wrong, it's harmful to citizen participation, and for this reason and the other concerns that you've heard here today, I urge you to oppose this bill as amended. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Seeing none. Thank you again, and Senator Sieben.
Mr. Chair, first, Mr. Goldsmith, I cut him off earlier. He still wanted to speak as the reasons for the overall bill. Perhaps he could do that briefly, but also I just consulted with him briefly, but hearing the concerns about that Senator Kiffmeyer, Senator Rest, and Senator Newman raised about the language on 5.16 as to what the definition of reliable media reports includes, I would ask the committee to please just delete reliable media reports and the comma from the language.
Okay, so we'll make that into an amendment, Senator Sieben, an oral amendment to on line 5.16, remove reliable media reports and the comma. Any discussion to the amendment? And there is one more amendment that would need to be made, too. If Council could state the change that we could maybe add to this oral amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Because we're getting rid of the middle part of the list, we'd also need to delete the comma on 5.15. So okay. That would be delete the comma on 5.15, and then on 5.16, delete reliable media reports, comma.
Okay. Everybody have that change? So Senator Sieben will incorporate that into her oral amendment. And all those in favor of the oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. And Mr. Goldsmith, did you want to speak further on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I just have a couple of very brief points that I want to make. First of all, bill was a board recommendation 2 years, 1 year ago, and it passed through this body. It passed the floor of the Senate. The provisions that you have before you now were taken out in the House and did not survive conference committee, and so this comes with the recommendation of the campaign finance board as a whole. All of the members voted in favor of it, although we've now had a change in membership. The whole board voted in favor of it again this year. I did want to comment on a couple of points that other speakers made because they raised concerns, and I think that they should be addressed at least briefly. One is the question of corporate penalties under Chapter 211B. And although the additional disclosure provisions were not adopted last year, the limits and easing of the corporate penalties were, in fact, adopted. And so if a corporation makes a prohibited contribution and it's not intentional, that corporation will be subject to only civil penalties, just like any other person making a prohibited contribution. Only if the corporation intentionally makes a prohibited contribution will the more severe penalties be required or available. And the intentional contribution is actually defined. The corporation would have to first know that the transaction is a contribution under statute, and secondly, that the donor is, in fact, a corporation. So if either of those things are missing, it's not an intentional contribution, and the criminal and corporate charter revocation provisions would not be available. My last comment, I'd just like to comment on Mr. Helmberger's point that this bill would be forcing false reporting. This argument was made last year as well. And in fact, that's not the case. The statement of underlying sources is not a statement that says these donors donated money for the purpose of making independent expenditures or electioneering communications. It's a statement that we, the association making these communications, have used money derived from these various donors. And remember, I pointed out to you that as a practical matter, donors of less than $10,000 won't be disclosed. But even if an association used 100% of its money for political purposes, donors of less than $5,000 would never be disclosed. So it's for those organizations that have many, many small donors, there will still typically be no underlying source disclosure. And with that, I'll end my testimony and stand for any questions.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Goldsmith, I appreciate what you're saying here, that underlying donor base maybe didn't, but I think in the public perception realm, if those names are listed in that such a way, there will be the perception and the construction, albeit maybe that is not what the board was intending to, but nonetheless, I guarantee you that in the general public, that will be the case, and it will be construed that way. and great unfairness to those donors. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Senator Sieben.
Just for a few closing arguments, I think that sometimes when we're within the legislature or under the dome, as they'll more broadly say, we can lose sight of what the general public perceives that we are doing on specific legislation. The way that I look at this is that when it comes time for an election, and there are television ads or flyers that come in the mail, and it says, did you know that Senator Sieben did X, Y, and Z? And it is clearly positive, let's say. But it does not say on that communication to vote for me. I think that the public still thinks that whoever is funding that is intending to influence the election. And that's the loophole we're trying to close here. That is the glaring loophole that we're trying to close. Outside the Capitol, people think that that groups are trying to influence our elections. And so this, I understand how there are, it is a lot of new language, and there are concerns. I think that it's important that we keep sight of that fact, that really we're trying to bring more disclosure and more transparency to the public so that they can understand and know who is trying to influence elections.
Thank you. And Senator Newman has a question.
Just a comment. excuse me. I assume we're going to proceed to a vote here fairly quickly. And just a comment. I agree with Senator Sieben's last comments. And I recognize that there are outside influences that are being made in an effort to affect the outcome of our elections. And in that, I believe Senator Sieben is correct, and I agree with her. I also think that there are abuses, significant abuses, in that occurred during an election cycle by both the Republican Party and by the DFL Party. And I think that a lot of our voters and our citizens are being misled by those communications. And so I happen to agree with what Senator Sieben is trying to do. I simply disagree with the way this bill is going to be implemented. And my specific objections to the bill are these. Is number one, and again, recognizing that this is an honest problem that we have and we should address. Number one, I am not at all convinced that Senate File 1915 is going to be applied equally to all organizations. And this is something that came up last year, and we're talking about it again this year, and I remain unconvinced that everyone, in terms of organizations, will be treated equally. The day that we incorporate some language into the electioneering express advocacy bill that addresses those concerns, we will, as far as this particular senator is concerned, will have taken a major step forward. The other reason that I disagree very strongly with this bill, and I have disagreed with other bills that have come forward, and I'm very consistent on this, is that there is simply too much power consolidated in the hands of too few. Mr. Goldsmith has been very, very gracious in articulating the responsibilities of the board. And in my conversations with him, he has never been anything other than helpful. But when I look at what the board wants here, I simply cannot agree. The board makes rules. The board writes advisory opinions. that no candidate ever disagrees with. This is a board bill in which the board is coming to us, and they're asking us for additional authority and additional jurisdiction. Then the board addresses complaints that are brought forward regarding candidates. And then the board investigates whether or not there has been a violation of the rules and advisory committees and legislation that they have promulgated. And then the board decides whether or not there has been a violation. And I will never agree that that is a good system, because it simply consolidates too much power in the hands of too few. And Senator Marty sat here earlier today and talked about the subliminal effect of someone who contributes $200 to a campaign. And I think that there is an effect. What's being proposed in terms of express advocacy is the same thing that was proposed last year. We're going to remove the magic words, which is an objective test, and we're going to go to the reasonable person standard, which is a subjective test. And we're going to allow the board that promulgated that request to make the subjective decision as to whether or not a violation has occurred. And I disagree with that concept. Then we're going to move on to electioneering communications, and we're going to give them the same authority. So, you know, I want to be very respectful to Senator Sieben and what she is trying to do here, because I agree with her. I want to be very respectful to Mr. Goldsmith and what he is trying to do, because I believe he is trying to do the right thing. But for the two reasons that I've outlined, there is simply no way that I can agree with this particular bill. And if it was to go back and rework so that I know that there is, in fact, a level playing field, and we're not going to give the board this literally unlimited authority to write the rules, to investigate violations of the rules that they have written, and to make a determination as to whether or not a violation has occurred, then I would be much more willing to get on board and support this kind of legislation. Thank you, Senator Sieben. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anything else? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Sieben, in Section 4, we talk of electioneering communications, and it creates a list of parameters that one could fit into that definition. I'm just wondering, in all of this bill, if one wanted to avoid falling under these rules, couldn't one just create an organization in the state of Wisconsin and Hudson and mail into the Twin Cities or anywhere else in the state of Minnesota and be outside of the enforcement mechanism of the state? And I was just wondering if you could answer that for me.
Senator Sieben.
Or any other state for that matter.
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, the answer is no. And I think it's because it's triggered. If the committee spends a certain amount of money in Minnesota, then they're required to register with the Campaign Finance Board. I'm looking to Mr. Goldsmith to see if that's correct or not.
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, that's correct. State election campaign finance laws extend beyond the borders of the state if the money comes into the state to affect the state's elections. For example, we have lots of national organizations, many in Washington, that are in our system, and some from other states as well.
Senator Limmer.
If an individual wanted to express his First Amendment rights and create opinions, make reports of how candidates voted, where does this cross the line between expression of First Amendment rights, whether it's by an individual or an organization, or now fitting into a regulation of what can be said and what cannot be said, or the manner in which it can be said. Where do we violate that principle?
Mr. Goldsmith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I didn't bring the case with me, but Citizens United was quite articulate in that situation, and they said very clearly that if a state wants to require disclosure about communications that mention a candidate during those periods before an election, it can do so constitutionally. We're talking about disclosure, not limits on how much speech can be involved. And so I think that case from a constitutional standpoint is closed.
And Ms. Senator Limmer, I know that there's been, well, maybe not so recently, but there has been Supreme Court decision cases that have kind of given a wide berth to individuals who want to influence campaigns through either a 529 organization or a C4 of some sort. And Supreme Court has kind of given it a very wide berth of their involvement. And would this affect or limit the decisions made in those types of decisions? Is that what we're attempting to do in this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, this bill is not intended to directly affect any court decision. It's intended to implement a model similar to the federal model that's been in place there and in 20-some states for quite a number of years and has been upheld by the court. So if there are other cases that are shedding light on this particular approach, I'm not aware of them.
Oh, one other question,
Senator Limmer.
In State Statute 10A, there's a reference to the limitations what an office holder could be involved in when it comes to a C4 or even a C3 organization. In some ways, I believe that an elected official may be prohibited from being a director of a C4 organization and being a party of it. And I was just wondering, does this in any way enhance or detract from that potential involvement, which may be a conflict of 10A?
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, the only provision in Chapter 10A that I'm aware of that regulates a candidate's involvement is that a candidate cannot directly or indirectly control another political committee or political fund. I don't think 10A has anything to say about candidate involvement with C4 or C3 corporations unless they were involved with a political committee or fund operated by one of those, and that is prohibited. This bill would not change that in any way.
Any further questions? Seeing none. Senator Sieben moves that Senate File 1915, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the full Committee on Rules. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails, and the bill is passed. So thank you, Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think